For those of you who heard my talk with Jim earlier this half hour, these are very strange times. Conflict in the Middle East that's expanding is affecting us on a daily level. It's polarizing everybody. It's letting the wolves out, as Jim said. But more than that, there's a feeling in the air that there's something qualitatively different about this conflict right now. They were sort of in a phony war. Israel didn't quite do the job that everybody wanted them to do in Lebanon, even though when they finally released their infantry, they got to the Litani River in about 36 hours. Iran took that as a sign, of course, to be bolder, to be more vicious, to be more dangerous. Iran was the story today. The UN was looking for a short, sweet answer that they would cooperate on nuclear proliferation. Nuclear inspection, and of course they didn't get it. They got a long, detailed letter at the same time that the Supreme Leader, Mr. Khamenei, was telling the West that it had no business anywhere in his caliphate, or what he hopes to be his caliphate. The Iranian foreign minister was in South Africa making some saber-rattling noises of his own. It's a very strange time. Yesterday we had this incredible spectacle of Canada being the first Western nation where three elected officials, three of our MPs, had been on a fact-finding trip to the Middle East, actually called for Hezbollah either to be taken off the terrorist list or conditions to be made easier for discussions with them. Now, exactly what there was going to be to discuss is up in the air. Nobody was clear on that, and they were all busy backtracking. But this whole atmosphere has got everything very, very weird, very strange. And there were two events today that pointed out just how polarizing and how strange these times are, and how, as Jim Duff said, the dogs are being let loose, the wolves are being let loose. In British Columbia, a member of the Liberal Party of Canada, British Columbia section, a member of that executive, a fellow by the name of Thomas Hubert, wrote on a liberal internet site the following comments that Israel, quote, is the most vile nation in human history, unquote, and that, quote, it is a state that survives in the blood of innocent people, unquote. Incredible words. I mean, this is reminiscent of blood libel. He was roundly condemned, of course. We're still waiting to see what the Liberal Party of Canada is going to do. Interestingly enough, Mr. Hubert, like Boris Rzeczynski, the MP, Liberal MP yesterday who called for Hezbollah to be taken off the terrorist list, are both supporters of Gerald Kennedy, who was the reform candidate, who paints himself as a reform candidate of the Liberal Party. At the same time, in the National Post, Martin Patrick, I hope, will be joining us later in the hour, and a very keen observer of the Quebec scene, wrote a piece on how many of the personalities that participated in that rally two Sundays ago that turned into kind of a minor pro-Hezbollah manifestation, how much of the Quebec press is now looking at them and saying, hey, wait a minute, what were you doing there? So we've got a polarization. I don't know if the polarization caused out of fear, or the fear of what could happen in the Middle East is making people take sides or waking people up who usually would have been asleep. We're going to be discussing all that this hour. And our first guest, John O'Sullivan, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, has a remarkable grounding in this part of the world and in these issues. And we'll introduce him and we'll start talking with him and welcoming your calls right after this. The tone of much coverage of the war was still that of Israel as Goliath versus Hezbollah, as David and some of the more remarkable novelties were, if not entirely missed and given less attention than they deserved. Like the question of who started it. The aggressor was neither one of Israel's Arab neighbors, nor even the Arab sub-state terrorist group Hezbollah, led by Hassan Nasrallah. Iran started the war, using Hezbollah as its agent and Syria as its transit camp. Iran supplied the weapons, the training, the diplomatic support, and even some volunteers. This war was the first Iranian-Israeli war, but not the last. Pretty frightening words if written by anybody. but very serious words and written by our first guest, John O'Sullivan, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington. But he's done much more than that. He's been editor-at-large of the National Review. He was part of the group that started the National Post in Canada. Originally from Britain, he was a special advisor to Prime Minister Thatcher, and he was a co-chairman of the New Atlantic Initiative, an international bipartisan effort dedicated to reinvigorating and expanding the Atlantic community democracies. John O'Sullivan, welcome and taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
John, this is a strange time we're in, is it not? It doesn't feel normal. It's not just another petty conflict in the Middle East, if there is such a thing.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think people sense that the conflict didn't so much end for good with the ceasefire, but in a sense it was the combatants pausing to rest and recuperate before going into a second round, and that I think is what's going to happen. And I think a second factor in all of this is that, and one of the things which make disputes about the Middle East at the moment so bitter within the West, is that there is now within Western society significant sections of people in Canada, in America, in Britain, in Australia, who dislike their own society very deeply and who consequently sympathize with that society's enemies and dislike its friends. So a lot of people who are cheering on Hezbollah and speaking out on its behalf and attacking Israel are inspired not so much by the local quarrels of the Middle East as by the local quarrels they feel at home.
How does the West react to that? Britain and France particularly, but are having a hard time reacting in a civilized manner, as they would like, to people who have taken much, been given much by those Western pluralist societies, and yet still, as you say, are disaffected. What is the way of response?
Well, it's a complicated question for two, because people are being pushed in two directions. First of all, the dominant political ideology in Western Europe, to less extent in Britain, but still to a but still effective there, the dominant political ideology is social democracy. And the social democrats and the left in European politics have in recent years become very hostile to Israel and even to the Jews as such. I mean, we have seen develop a new kind of anti-Semitism rooted not in the right, not in the questions of the right, but in hostility to Israel and to the Jews who support it in the West. And the second thing is that the European governments have suddenly woken up very late in the day to the threat to themselves and their interests from the radical coalition in the Middle East, led by Iran, but also including Syria and the terrorist groups Hezbollah, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad. So you have this radical coalition in the Middle East, which previously they thought was a threat to Israel, and now they suddenly see that it is a threat to them, because they have agents of that, in a very considerable number, agents of that kind of radical coalition, in the Muslim coalition, in their own society, and now, of course, we're seeing in things like the Madrid bombings, the London subway bombings, the attempt to blow up the airliners, we're seeing just what dangers that can pose to ordinary people in the West.
Many observers have juxtaposed the British response and even the response after the foiled bomb plot of just several days ago of looking at Muslim disaffection in Britain with the Sarkozy approach, as it's called in France, of legislating conformity to the modèle républicain, to the split between protecting the secular nature of the state from any parochial particularities of any faith. Is there a middle ground, or do we have to really now go for the jugular, for just to protect whatever pluralistic liberalism there may be in the West?
Well, in the first place, of course, we have to acknowledge that the vast majority of Muslim immigrants and the children who are born in Britain or in other European countries are perfectly peaceable and law-abiding. We also have to acknowledge that a significant minority are not. And of that minority, some are active, but most probably are simply sympathetic. The polls show sympathetic to things like September the 11th or the London subway bombings and the aims of the bombers. So that's the first thing, is to realize that we have a complicated problem here, and it can't be solved by any simple, easy thing. The next thing is, I think, what is it legitimate to demand of our Muslim co-citizens, fellow citizens?
And John, I just have to take one break and pay some bills, and
Sure.
We'll get back to that thought right after this. Montreal will be right back with John O'Sullivan. Tonight we're talking about the temper of our times, and these are strange days, particularly with the vibes and the news coming out of Iran and where they're heading. And our very special guest tonight is John O'Sullivan, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington. John, before the break, you were about to make the point about where we go. What is our way of response to Muslim populations that have serious minorities within them that are disaffected, populations within Western countries, Western Europe and North America?
Well, it's a complicated question. As I was saying, we have to make sure we don't alienate the majorities of the minorities who are decent, law-abiding people. And there are generally commonsensical answers to a lot of the questions that crop up. For example, a few years ago, last year, in fact, in England, there was a case of a young woman who wanted to wear the full burqa to school. Now, the headmistress of the school, who was herself a Muslim, devised an extremely good uniform which reflected Muslim concept of modesty and also was smart and attractive and which could have been worn by girls who were Muslim or not and made it the school uniform. Now, that was then overturned briefly by the courts, who said that the girl had a human right to wear that uniform. Now, I understand that, and I wouldn't want to stop, Muslim women wearing headscarves. That kind of thing, which I think was attempted in France, seems to me to be an overreaction. But there is a principle here, and that is when something is being worn not as an expression of modesty, but as a uniform, a political uniform, intended to intimidate and separate people out, I think that crosses a certain line. In the 1930s in Britain, we passed the law, the Public Order Act, which prevented people walking around dressed essentially like Nazi stormtroopers.
Oswald Mosley's group.
Exactly. Hello.
Yes.
There's going on there. I don't know what.
It's all right. There's a little background noise, but it's okay.
Yes. That I think was accepted by everybody because those uniforms were intended to intimidate Jews, as it happened. I think it's that there are solutions here, and I think the Muslim headmistress, who eventually I think won her case in England, was a good way to go.
But of course, John, the acculturation issue is of course not what has created, as you have written, this strange new alliance of Shia and Sunni Muslims of Iran and Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and perhaps the Wahhabis. Is this an opportunity that this new alliance sees, or is it a last gasp that they're trying to effect?
I think they're aggressive at the moment, not because they're losing, but because they sense they might be winning. They sense that we have no confidence in our own civilization and society, and we're not really prepared to defend it. And in the case of the Middle East, they think that they have the Israelis on the run. Now, they're wrong about that, in my view. Israel did not win this war, but it will probably win the next one. But they're not wrong about our own lack of confidence in our own society and values. And we have to make that absolutely plain. We have to make it plain in a decent way. And indeed, most of the values that we hold dear will also be respected and admired by Muslim members of our own society. But we have to say to Muslims, just as they can say to us, we expect tolerance, which is one of your virtues, and we should say to them, and we expect that Muslims will regard Canada or the Queen of Canada, the Queen of England, as the supreme political authority in their societies, and not simply regard the countries in which they now live as a place, but to which they owe no loyalty or allegiance. That's the point of principle we have to make.
John, I'd like you to stay with us through the news and stay with me as we take one or two callers if you have the time.
Sure.
Thanks very much. Montreal will be right back with John O'Sullivan and your calls. We're back with our very special guest, John O'Sullivan, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, former advisor to Prime Minister Thatcher of Britain, former editor-at-large for National Review. Not much John O'Sullivan hasn't done and doesn't know, and he has written a very compelling article that calls the recent Middle East conflict the first Iranian-Israeli war. And we're talking tonight, and we want to hear from you, about the qualitative difference in the temper of our times today, particularly with the news coming out of Iran and their brashness and their arrogance and their almost contempt for any attempt at reaching any kind of reasonable ground with the West. And John has kindly agreed to stay with us as we take some callers. Helen from Kutzing Luke. Good evening.
Good evening. Wise but man. You sure are a wise man.
Well, one tries.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that democracies are fertile ground for the jihad to plant those seeds, and that their idea is to take over the world with jihad.
Well, as you heard John O'Sullivan say earlier, democracies were fertile ground, obviously, for right-wing movements.
Lebanon was a democracy. It was a lovely country, and they allowed it to happen. And, I am so disgusted with us, with our country, except that I like Harper very much. He's got some guts. There are so many Muslims where I live, and they don't integrate at all.
Well, I don't think it's a question so much of Muslims or anybody else. I think it's a question of a political ideology that coats a religious belief and that grows on that religious belief, and that's what John O'Sullivan was talking about earlier about the majority. And John, but Helen's frustration is that we're so open in Canada, particularly to everybody. We've got this multicultural policy that every government sort of handles like a jewel as representing what we are without ever telling anybody who comes to this country, as you alluded to before the break, well, this is what we are. It's not just about the Queen. You come here, it's about us as a liberal pluralist society. How does one balance that with a multicultural model that Canada has developed, or is it time to scrap it?
Well, the first thing to say is that multiculturalism and democracy can't coexist with high levels of immigration. If you have moderate levels of immigration so that newcomers and the communities of newcomers, whether they're Muslims or some other religion, are a relatively small percentage of the population, they never pose a threat. Even when they don't integrate, it doesn't matter that much because there are sufficiently few of them that the rest of the society is able to cope with whatever problems are thrown up. It's when you have mass immigration on the one hand, and secondly, you don't have integration on the other. I mean, integration is the opposite of multiculturalism. And multiculturalism is a doctrine that encourages people to retain identities that are separate from and different from the identity of the Canadian majority.
I just want to interrupt you for just one second. You bring back a memory of something that the late Prime Minister Trudeau said in 1995. He said that one of his great disappointments is that his multicultural vision, instead of helping people celebrate the diversities within the Canadian universality, simply became a pig trough for people getting checks from government for their favorite programs and a way for governments to buy votes.
Yes, but his original idea was nonsensical anyway. The fact is, you can't have an identity that consists of 25 different identities, and what you have is 25 different identities, not one Canadian identity. And I'm afraid that Pierre Trudeau is one of the villains of this story in Canada and throughout the Western world. America's great success until the last 20 years in being able to integrate large numbers of immigrants from different communities was that it transformed them into Americans. Now, that was perfectly consistent. Being American was perfectly consistent with perhaps being privately Jewish or privately Muslim or privately Catholic. But it did mean accepting the values, the public values of the society in public. And that's something which we have to recover the self-confidence to be able to do in future. And we all used to have it, you know. The Canadians had it.
Everybody had it. And it recalls in 1865 Thomas D'Arcy McGee saying, "There is room in this northern dominion under one flag and one set of laws for one great people. There is no possibility for that greatness under that same flag and those same laws if we succumb to 1,000 squabbling particularities." John O'Sullivan, thanks very much for joining us. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Montreal, we'll be right back. Or email us at info@iepm.ca. And tonight we're talking about the temper of our times, how this period seems qualitatively different. Iran's threat that we've just talked with John O'Sullivan about. Let's bring it home a bit. And joining us now is Martin Patrickin, a well-known journalist who has just written a fascinating little piece in the National Post today. Martin, thank you for joining us.
No,
welcome.
How are you?
And I want to bring it home in the sense that we started this hour in the original discussion with Jim Duff about how this whole atmosphere is going to separate the wolves and the dogs and bring them all out. I was struck by your op-ed today, Martin, Quebec's popular pariah, and I'll explain what that was in a second, but the same day that we had this incredible, vile, odious commentary by this fellow Hubert, who was on the Liberal Party of Canada's BC Executive Council, who puts on one of the internet sites that Israel is the most vile nation in human history, and that it survives on the blood of innocent people, and of course he's been roundly condemned. And the juxtaposition of what you wrote about. Now, you wrote about the August 6th demonstration in Montreal that was supposed to be a demonstration for peace for Lebanon and Palestine that ended up almost as a quasi-Hezbollah rally, and Pierre Falardeau, a very popular filmmaker in Quebec who has been criticized for walking hand-in-hand with his friend Julien Poulin, and Poulin carrying a Hezbollah flag. Now, one interesting thing that has happened in Quebec since that demonstration, I'd like you to comment on this, Martin.
Yep.
That demonstration caused a lot of anxiety and anger. Why were political leaders like Duceppe and Boisclair? Yes, they couldn't control demonstration, but once they saw what it was heading, what it was doing, once they saw the defiled Jewish prayer shawls, once they saw the posters of Nasrallah, get out.
Leave.
Anger at Quebec. Leave, exactly. Yeah. Now, in the days following, what you're describing in Quebec's popular pariah, and I really recommend that people go to the National Post website and read this, or better yet, buy a National Post and read it. You're describing something that is changing in the past few days. That we've seen it in a lot of the Francophone press in Quebec. That these people are there are caricatures being made of these, and
yeah.
And you bring that out.
The thing that I found interesting about it was, I mean, of course, you can expect someone like Falardeau to do what he did and to come out and say that, you know, Hezbollah are freedom fighters, et cetera, what has been a markedly different, which I really like, is the fact that people are coming out and saying, wait a minute, it's not good to do this. You can't do this. You can't get away with this just because you're who you are. Which is, I mean, there's a number of columnists who have pointed this much out. I mean, there was hardcore sovereignist people who are saying, why on earth would you say what you said? Why would you come out and do this? And this guy's like a deity to them, right? And it's the first time that I can think of where this has actually happened, where someone like Falardeau isn't necessarily untouchable as he always is.
You have your pulse very much on your finger on the pulse very much of this province, and I want to know if you've been noticing what I've been noticing. I was very harsh in my criticism of Boisclair and Duceppe and others, and I was very harsh also of certain of the elite media. Let's call them the elite media. Some of the commentators on 98.5, let's call it, who insist on using les Juifs instead of les Israéliens when talking about the conflict. Les Juifs instead of les Israéliens. Some columnists in the French press in Montreal who defended the attendance of high-profile people at this rally. But what I've been getting in the past few days is a lot of people calling from Le Québec Profond and saying, hey, our local paper was really mad at this. A lot of people from the Quebec City area, from Sherbrooke, saying, this does not make us very pleased. We are not pro-Hezbollah. Is there a disconnect between the media elites in Montreal and the rest of Quebec?
I'd say that as far as I can tell, and as far as the columnists and the people that I quoted in the article, everybody I found has been fairly critical of what happened. That said, I mean, I didn't listen to, for example, you brought up 98.5. I didn't hear that, and I mean that's absurd. Not making that you know the difference between Israel and les Juifs. I mean that's basically a racist statement. As far as local media is concerned, it's very much you get that a lot. I mean, I worked at the Sherbrooke Record forever, a long time ago, and
forever. You're only 25.
Oh, I'm 30. I worked there for quite a while.
Right.
And you got a lot of that. You got and the reason that people read those papers is because of you get opinions that aren't necessarily the status quo, and which is actually quite refreshing. And having been in national media for a little while, it's sort of what I strive to do, is to give something that isn't necessarily going to be in the paper, that you figure will be in the paper.
Right.
Yeah.
Martin, stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. We're going to pay some bills. We'll be right back with Martin Patrickin, talking about Quebec's popular pariah. Or email us at info@iapm.ca, and we're talking with Martin Patrickin. But Quebec's reaction to Pierre Falardeau, a very popular filmmaker who was carrying a Hezbollah flag, and generally about the reaction to that August 6th march. Martin, you wrote in your piece, you wrote very elegantly and pointedly, anointing Hezbollah with a certain Robin Hood je ne sais quoi is typical Falardeau. Is approving anybody who's anti-American or perceived to be the representative of people who are oppressed, no matter that they're supported by an almost terrorist state, is that typical here? Is that can you get by on facade? Is that a disconnect between Quebec and the rest of Canada now? Never mind Montreal and the rest of Quebec.
The idea to fall into a bit of a romanticism, and to sort of equate our situation or the French-speaking Quebecer situation with any other plight in the world is something that's particular to this province. But I mean, that's because we're different than everybody else.
A question of self-doubt here? Is it a question of misinterpretation of Quebec history, or is it just is there somewhat of an anti-Americanism here that will react to anybody who's anti-American,
well,
anti-West?
You got to remember too that we're talking about Falardeau here, and he's one example. But we've always had this sort of idea of you know, blowing things up, exaggerating. For example, you know, René Lévesque calling Westmount White Rhodesia. You know, I mean, that's
yeah.
That's so insulting to black people, you know, in that part of Africa. It's absurd because, I mean, it's nothing to do with reality. Yet that's the sort of idea, the romanticism, the exaggeration of building up Quebec as being, you know, being under the foot of the English evil man and stuff like this. And that's associated with Israel. That's associated with the States, what have you.
You know, do we have a chance? You know. Je suis, je reste, and there's a, you know, obviously a million of us here who are here and who are staying. And I remember having a conversation with Andre Boisclair last year and saying to him, you know, if you run the party, the Parti Québécois, if you run on a platform of fidélité à la démocratie sociale, fidelity to social democracy, not to sang et langue, not to blood and language,
mm-hmm.
you'll have a chance to reach a lot of people who are on the same page. Ever going to come out of the, you know, sang et langue, the blood and language period?
I don't know. A friend of mine was talking to Pierre Mark Johnson some years ago, and he mentioned something interesting in this conversation. Mr. Johnson said, you know, the one thing we did wrong is that we sort of forgot about that minority. We forgot about the English people, forgot how to bring them in. And they haven't, and by them I say the PQ, they haven't figured out how to do that because they have these are the radical roots that they have to be beholden to,
right.
You know, and still their number one, on their charter is the separation of Quebec. Like, and you can't get beyond that sort of that obsession,
that idée fixe.
Well, yeah, with that written into your constitution, I don't know what the answer to your question is, and it's not my gut feeling is that it's not ever going to get beyond that. It's inherently. I don't think it's going to happen in a long time.
Well, then you and I will just have to sit and enjoy the terraces of Montreal and debate this for the next 30 years
with
everybody else. Martin Patrick, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, sir. Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Bye.
My thanks to Chris Smith, the Master Control. My thanks to all of you out there. Back with you.